questions.
Would you be able to go over the last weather sign question with find the temperature of the universe with?
Oh, with an adiabatic expansion? So we're looking at 28, which was, I think somebody said, the last WebAssign problem. The universe is expanding, and we're supposed to treat the hydrogen as an ideal gas. If the density of the gas in the universe is one hydrogen atom per cubic centimeter, calculate the number of moles per unit volume, calculate the pressure in the universe using the temperature relationship. The current radius of the universe is x, find the pressure. Oh, the previous one.
Yeah, the temperature when the Earth is the size of like a nutshell or something.
Okay. So it's atomic hydrogen. So it's monoatomic. Hydrogen at room temperature is diatomic. But they say atomic hydrogen, so we want to be using the 5/3 form. And we have this, so people typically remember PV to the gamma is a constant for adiabatic expansion, but if you use the ideal gas law, you can convert that to that form of it. So we have that the temperature times the volume to the 5/3 minus 1 is a constant, and of course 5/3 minus 1 is 2/3. So if we set this up as a V1 T1 equals V2 T2 sort of situation, we have T1 V1 to the 2/3 is equal to T2 V2 to the 2/3. So what we know is the current temperature, 3.7 Kelvin, and what we're interested in is the final temperature, the original temperature. So if we just rearrange this, we got that. Now the ratio of volumes, volume goes like the radius cubed. So this is going to be the radius divided by the original radius to the cubed 3/2 is going to be squared. So the current radius of the universe, they're saying, is a particular number, and the final radius is at it. I think it's just a plug and chug from there.
Okay. Thank you.
So I know, can you see where your mistake might have been, or?
Yeah, I just didn't know how to set it up.
Okay. It doesn't.
If you use 5/3,
but if you
use 1.672. So it's like instead of to the instead of squared at the end, it's to the 2.01.
2.01. Boy, that's a funny number. I can't think of any reason for 2.01.
It didn't work for me.
Exactly two.
Yeah.
So it must be a kind of a rounding problem, and I've seen those before. They are probably using 1.67.
Yeah, it says to use that, so then at the end you come up with 2.01 is exactly 2.
Yeah, well, not good.
Can you pour some hot water into that liquid nitrogen?
A little bit louder?
Can you pour some hot water into the liquid nitrogen?
Why? Yeah, you can. So, nothing interesting is going to happen. So, is the stress on hot water?
Yes.
Well, I think my answer is going to be no. It's going to take a minute to get hot water. We can do it after class. More questions? Okay. Well, maybe a good starting point as any is to think about what's coming up. So we've got an exam on not the next class meeting we have, but the one after that, which is the Thursday after Thanksgiving. I know you all are planning on studying really hard over Thanksgiving. There are a bunch of things you might want to look at if you want to. This one here, so I think that the screencasts are not too painful to view, and you can always just turn them off if you're not learning anything, not like class. So that's kind of a made-up exam that might be similar to your exam in terms of the problem type content. So remember that I gave you Q7 but then didn't grade it, so I said I would give you the solution eventually. So there's a screencast that gives the solution to the Bernoulli equation problem that we had but didn't have. And of course the other quiz, Q8, is also online. We're going to have another quiz Tuesday, and it's going to deal with stuff we're going to talk about today. So the remaining issue is to pick a time for kind of a help session. So you remember we vote on these. Typically we're thinking a day before, the day before, the day before, and before dinner or after dinner.
Is Tuesday after we take the quiz going to be like all the other days before the exams in which we have like...
Yes. So yeah, so there will be, so for the previous review things, aside from people saying I give away too many points, I'm going to do it the same way. So I'm going to hand out sample problems, and I will give you bonus points if you work it, and even more bonus points if you're the only one to get it correct. No, maybe I'll rethink it. But at least I'm going to hand out those sorts of problems. It usually doesn't hurt anybody to give a few people lots of bonus points, because it absolutely doesn't affect anyone else's grade except theirs. The system is designed so that those bonus points are added in at the end, not at the middle. So if I give somebody a zillion bonus points, it has absolutely no effect on your grade. I promise you. Trust me. Okay, so voting on help. Right, so Tuesday, Wednesday, before dinner, after dinner. Comments before we vote? People like Tuesday. Do they like before dinner or after dinner?
Do Tuesday and Wednesday.
Tuesday after. I won't be able to make any of them. Tuesday
after dinner. Okay, so who's for Tuesday before dinner? Somebody says it's a day six. One, two, three, four, five. I see six, seven people. How about Tuesday after dinner? I see one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. How about Wednesday before? Oh, I see a good number. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. One, two, three, five, six, seven, eight. And how about Wednesday after? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. So it's a toss-up. It'll probably be decided by the other class, would be my guess. Yes, there will be, but not mine, so I could still teach it. More questions? Okay, so usually there are like two or three equations. So just to be different, we've got, six times four equations. My best guess is that you're going to want to basically Xerox this and put it on your cheat sheet for all of these different paths. Some of them are pretty obvious. Since work has to do with change in volume, if the volume doesn't change, then the work has to be zero. Entropy has, an adiabat, a constant entropy curve, has to do with there being no change in, no heat gained or lost, so that one has to be zero. Internal energy depends on the temperature for an ideal gas, so if the temperature doesn't change, then the internal energy isn't going to change. But a lot of these are subtly different, right? So here's a CP for the molar specific heat at constant pressure, and here's a CV for the specific heat at constant volume. So that little difference between a subscript makes a moderately big difference, because the specific heat at constant pressure is an extra value of R onto CV. There's kind of a trick, which I don't think we use when we're working these problems, but all of these specific heats are basically a number times R. So very commonly, you end up multiplying some number times NR times the change in temperature. And you may not need to calculate the change in temperature, because that's equal to just pressure and volumes multiplied together. And if it's a PV curve, you're going to know the pressure and volume directly. It's not that hard to use the ideal gas to calculate the temperature, but you can often save a step by doing that sort of trick. One thing to kind of remember is the shape of these curves. Of course, if the pressure is constant, it's going to be a horizontal line. If the volume is constant, it's going to be a vertical line. If the temperature is constant, it's a hyperbole. It looks kind of like that. The adiabats, the constant entropy lines, are steeper than the isotherms. So they look more like that. Okay, so we have these names, and this is the one that I always have to look up, so I will never use it without defining it more carefully. But we have constant temperature, constant pressure, constant volume, constant entropy, adiabatic paths where there's no change in heat. And I guess the other kind of warning I give you, if you pick up 80% of the books, they will not have a minus sign there. That is to say, they will define W to be the work done by the gas as opposed to the work we do on the gas. Right? If you're designing steam engines, what you care about is how much coal you have to buy and how much horsepower you're going to get out. So it's more normal to define W, the work we get out of the fluid, as opposed to the work we get into the fluid. So if we're looking for a powerful engine, we're looking for a big negative number for the net work done. Any questions? Okay, so we have actually a fair number of topics to talk about. And maybe the first one to talk about is the last one that's in the chapter, because we've already been talking about it, and that's entropy. So the change in entropy just depends on the heat that you add to the material. So if you add heat to a material at some temperature T, then there's going to be a corresponding change in the entropy. Now, this equation is assuming that the temperature doesn't change while we're doing this process. So if we're adding heat to a piece of aluminum and the temperature changes noticeably during that process, then we have to add up all of the little changes in entropy that occur over a more or less constant change in temperature. And under those circumstances, what we're going to get is the, I'll write it in terms of m's, because I'm thinking of a piece of aluminum where we've usually had specific heats per gram. So that would be mc times the natural logarithm of the final temperature to the initial temperature. So entropy has kind of a funny history. All of this work that we're talking about, thermodynamics, was developed in the 1800s. And also during the 1800s, the idea of conservation of energy came into play. And what the people who were doing thermodynamics discovered is there was kind of a funny quantity, which for good heat engines was conserved, kind of like energy. And so they named it entropy, kind of in analogy to energy. But it's kind of a bad idea. It has different units than energy, right? These guys here, enthalpy and Gibbs free energy, they have the units of energy, and it's kind of useful to think of them as being kind of like energy. But entropy is not like energy. It has different units than energy. It comes closest to being a measurement of disorder. And I think I've mentioned this famous dead physicist Boltzmann, who wrote the famous equation that the entropy was equal to k times the natural logarithm of w that's on his tombstone, where w is a measurement of the number of available states. So we have kind of a funny situation with entropy. People discovered it as a mathematical oddity, something that was constant for good steam engines, but not necessarily constant for all sorts of processes. And in that regard, it's what's called a state function. So we've run into lots of state functions, right? So in fact, it's hard even to kind of comment about the stateness of functions because it's so obvious. So if we talk about a gas that goes between this state and that state, it doesn't matter how you get there. The temperature at that location is a certain value. The pressure at that location is a certain value. Doesn't matter how we got there, but that pressure is going to have that particular value. The volume, the energy, all of those concepts, all of those values just depend on the state of the gas, not on how we got there. And entropy is another state function that just depends on the pressure, temperature, volume of the gas at that location. Now, for the other state functions, we have an idea of what's going on physically. Right? We know that pressure has to do with these bouncing atoms, so if you tell me how fast the atoms are moving, I can calculate the pressure on first principles. We know that temperature is a measurement of the kinetic energy. So once people discovered mathematically this state function, they asked themselves, you know, what is it? What physically is involved that makes this state function? What is it a state of that we could calculate from first principles? And that's what Boltzmann did. He realized that this W, the number of possible microstates that correspond to that macrostate, is the thing that's behind entropy. And that's kind of a tricky thing to think about, but I guess what I do want to emphasize is that you can, for simple situations, so if you want to know what the entropy is of point particles that are bouncing around inside of a gas, we can calculate what the entropy is without using this definition the way it was originally found, that the change in entropy was the heat divided by the temperature. So these days you should really think about entropy as something that is tabulated, like in the CRC. So we'll, I hope, eventually talk about this problem, and you can look up in big tables what the entropy is of, in this case it's steam, under various volumes and temperatures. Okay, so the important thing is that if we have a process that is reversible, then there's no change in the entropy. So far, what we've seen as a nice reversible path is the adiabatic compression, right? There's no change in the entropy under those situations. What is always true is that if we look at the total entropy, not just the entropy of the fluid, but the entropy of the whole universe, including whatever is heating or cooling that fluid, then the change in the entropy is always greater than or equal to zero. And that's called the second law of thermodynamics. Now, that's a fairly obscure way of talking about the second law of thermodynamics. There are lots of equivalent ways of talking about the second law that work just as well. So, for example, I think the first version of the second law of thermodynamics was that it was impossible to make a heat engine that just converted heat directly to work, or that it was impossible to spontaneously have heat flow from a cold object to a hot object. So those are summaries of observations, right? You never see a cold object spontaneously getting colder because it's giving up its heat to a hot object. You see the reverse all the time. Whereas this is kind of a more abstract statement that the disorder of the universe is always increasing overall. So you can order your room, you can clean up your room if you want, but the result is that the universe ends up more disordered at the end of the day. Okay, so entropy, it's a state function. We can calculate changes. In fact, how it was originally discovered is by looking at changes in entropy given by the heat divided by the temperature. That formula requires the temperature to be constant, and we won't have much use for this formula. It's not a formula that's in the book, but if we're adding heat to something like aluminum and the temperature is changing noticeably while we're adding that heat, then that's another version of the change in entropy. And the second law says that the entropy of the whole universe, everything always has to increase. For a reversible process, the change in entropy has to be zero. Okay. So kind of the second big piece of this chapter has to do with these kind of funny diagrams. So instead of looking at PV diagrams where things are always a little bit complicated, we can simplify them a lot at least to aid understanding. And what we have is this picture of a hot temperature reservoir and a cold temperature reservoir. And the idea is we're going to take some energy from this hot reservoir and we're going to turn some fraction of it into work. And the remainder, we're going to have to dump in the cold register. Okay, now it doesn't matter whether these things are absolutely warm or absolutely cold. We've seen this heat engine, which is running between the temperature of liquid nitrogen and room temperature, just fine. All right, so even though we call these things heat engines, they work just fine with cold. All we need is a temperature difference between these two reservoirs in order to get some work out of the system. So again, one of the statements of the second law of thermodynamics is that this is impossibility. You can't convert 100% of the heat from a hot temperature reservoir into work. We have to dump some energy here into the cold reservoir. Okay. Now, these diagrams are a little bit tricky because what we're talking about here is the net work. So if we have a PV diagram sort of situation, then we know that we're getting net work out. We're getting a lot of negative work, that is to say the gas is doing work through all of that process, but then we have to do work to recompress it. So what this diagram is showing us is just the network, just the area of that PV diagram. It's not looking at the details that we're going to have to do some work and the gas is going to have to do some work. Now overall, the way heat engines work, I hope is pretty obvious. What we're going to do is to have the gas expand when it's hot. When the gas is hot, there's going to be a big pressure on it. And so it's going to push pretty hard. When we bother to compress the gas, we're going to have it be cold, so the pressure is less. Right? So we get a big push when it's hot, and then when we decide to compress it, it's going to be cold, so it doesn't take as much work in order to push it back. So that's how we get some net work out of our heat engine. Okay. So the next kind of important idea that's in this chapter is an idea that actually started thermodynamics due to a French engineer called Carnot. And what Carnot figured out is the most efficient possible heat engine. And first of all, what I mean by efficient is that for a given amount of work, I don't have to buy much coal. So what I mean by efficiency then is the ratio of the work I get out divided by how much coal I have to buy, how much heat I have to pull from that hot temperature reserve. Now, if we want to be a little bit careful, this Q is technically speaking negative because we're pulling heat out of that reservoir. So maybe I should put absolute value signs on that one. And this heat that I'm adding to the cold temperature reservoir, we'd usually call that a positive heat, so I wouldn't necessarily have to put absolute values around it. And maybe I should put absolute values around W because I'm talking about the work that I actually get out of the heat engine as opposed to the negative work that we have to do. So you can pay your money and take your choice, but what we want is the work out divided by the amount of coal we have to buy, the heat that we're pulling from the heat engine. So what Carnot showed is you can't do better than the following. What you have is a hot gas, and you let it expand isothermally. And of course, while it's doing that, it's doing work. That is to say that W is less than zero. Now, we need to get this gas cold if we're going to recompress it. And so what we let it do is to expand. You remember that if you let a gas expand adiabatically, it's going to reduce in temperature. So we have an adiabat where the temperature of the gas goes down. When the temperature gets to the cool isothermal, then when it's easy to compress, that's when we bother to compress it. Now we need to get it hot again in order to get back to a cycle. So what we do is we run an adiabat and we compress that gas, and in the process it gets heated. So a Carnot cycle consists of adiabats alternating with isothermals. And here's going to be the hot temperature. So heat is being added here. Here's the cold isotherm. Heat is being dumped into the cold temperature regime there. At these adiabats, of course, no heat is being lost or gained from the gas because that's the definition of an adiabat. Of course, work is being done during this adiabat, right, because there's going to be area under that curve. So if this engine is going to be the most efficient possible, it's going to have no change in entropy. And we can calculate what that change in entropy is going to be. So we're pulling heat from this high temperature regime. So that's going to be a reduction in entropy. So I'm going to write that as minus the absolute value of the heat we pull from the high temperature regime. Divide that by the temperature of that regime. And then we're going to dump some heat in the cold temperature regime. And the sum of those entropies are going to be zero if we have a reversible engine, and hence an engine that is going to have the maximum efficiency. So if we kind of rearrange this equation a little bit, what we've got then is the absolute value of the heat we pull from the high temperature regime divided by its temperature. Well, I'll write absolute value signs even though I don't need them. That has to be the same thing as the heat that I get out of the low temperature regime. And you can see, if I bring this TC up, since the cold temperature is obviously less than the hot temperature, that initial ratio is going to be less than 1. So I'm dumping less heat in the cold register than I took from the hot one. And that means that I've got work, right? There's some difference that's left over. So the work is going to be the difference in the heat I pull from the high temperature regime less the heat that I dump in the low temperature regime. And that over that is 1. So I have 1 minus the ratio of the heat I dump in the cold temperature regime divided by the heat that I pulled from the high temperature regime. And if we just rearrange that, you can see that's 1 minus the cold temperature divided by the hot temperature. So because there's no entropy change, this system is reversible, so I can run this thing backwards. Instead of dumping heat in the cold temperature regime, I can pull heat from that. It's going to take some work, and I can dump that heat in the high temperature regime. And that's exactly what a refrigerator is doing, right? The motor turns, and heat is pulled out of the inside of the refrigerator, and it's dumped to where it's warm, namely in the kitchen. Now, what we might talk about for a refrigerator is, instead of the efficiency, is going to be what's usually called the coefficient of performance. And what, if we're running a steam engine, what we care about is how much coal do we have to buy and how much work do we get out. If we're running a refrigerator, what we care about is what the bill is to NSP, that is to say, how much work do we have to do, and how much heat do we pull out of the cold temperature regime. So we want to get rid of as much heat as we can. So a good coefficient of performance would be the heat we're pulling from the cold temperature regime divided by the work. Now we can rearrange this if we want, because we know that the work is the difference between the heat that we dump in the high temperature regime minus the heat we've pulled from the cold temperature regime. And if I divide top and bottom by the heat in the cold temperature regime, this is going to be 1 over hot over cold minus 1. And we know that this ratio is the same thing as hot over cold minus 1. Maybe I'll write this one more time. If I multiply top and bottom by TC, this is the temperature difference between the inside of the refrigerator and the outside of the refrigerator, dividing into the temperature inside the refrigerator. And maybe I haven't said it, but of course all of these temperatures want to be in Kelvin. Okay, so entropy, it's a measurement of disorder. This is the equation we've actually got for changes in entropy. It depends on the heat divided by the temperature. You can only use that equation if the temperature doesn't change. The lower equation will never occur on an exam, but I give it to you as what the entropy change would be if there was a change in temperature. Boltzmann has this on his tombstone. It's a very famous equation, but it's not one we can actually use, right? Because we can't actually calculate the number of, we can't in this class, calculate the number of accessible states. But as a matter of fact, that's what the state function entropy is about. It's about the disorder of the universe. And we've got these kind of pretty pictures, which are kind of summarizing the situation involved in heats and works. And remember that we are separately treating the heat that goes in the cold temperature regime from the heat that's pulled from the high temperature regime, but we're lumping together all of the works, right? So the positive works and the negative works, that all goes together into the network in that diagram. And then we've proven some relationships for Carnot cycles in terms of the efficiency of a Carnot heat engine and the coefficient of performance of a Carnot refrigerator. And you can show that it's impossible to do better than those efficiencies and coefficients of performance. Questions? Well, I wanted to talk, since we're talking about heat engines, I wanted to talk a little bit about real heat engines. So an old student of mine runs this power plant in Lansing, Iowa. Yeah, I don't know if that's particularly visible, but that's what the inside of his power plant looks like. So these are the turbines, and they have this characteristic shape because they involve adiabatic expansion. Right? So the stuff goes in here and then it expands, so we need more volume here at the end of this turbine than we have at the beginning. This is, of course, where we're getting things hot in the boiler. This is where, in this case, coal is being burned. This particular guy also worked on nuclear reactors, so you can get the water hot any way you want to. And if we look at detail, kind of what's involved in this funny picture, this is kind of a simplification of what's going on in this real heat engine. It's not a Carnot cycle. People don't make heat engines with Carnot cycles. There are various reasons for that. So first of all, this is a really funny diagram in that I have temperature versus volume. Usually we have pressure versus volume. And not only that, I've got temperature in degrees Celsius as opposed to Kelvin. And you know that Kelvin is pretty much what we always want. But by using temperature in Celsius, I was able to kind of simplify the diagram a little bit. So the area under this dotted line is where you can have water as a liquid and water as a vapor coexisting. So for example, at 100 degrees Celsius, we could have a very small volume of liquid water, or we could have a very big volume of water vapor, and we could have everything in between depending upon what fraction of it is in little droplets and what fraction of it is in vapor. A term that's called the quality factor. So the way this heat engine works is we have very high pressure, so this is megapascals, very high pressure liquid water, and we're going to boil that water at constant pressure. And of course, it's also going to boil at constant temperature, so both the isobar and the isotherm are the same thing for boiling as we go from 100% liquid to 100% vapor. And then we're going to continue to heat that vapor, still under isobaric conditions, to this very high temperature. And during all of this stuff, even though work is being done by the gas, it's not being collected by the turbine. The only place the turbine is doing work is in this adiabatic expansion from this very high temperature to this very cold temperature. So inside the turbine, we're going from 1,000 degrees to something like room temperature, with a huge expansion, right? An expansion ratio of about 100, which is why we needed those cone-shaped turbines. So at this point, we have water vapor that's just a little bit above what's necessary to condense it. So we cool it a little bit, and then we can have it condense into liquid water, huge change in volume, and then we can push it back into the boiler and start the process again. Okay, so real heat engines don't usually work on the Carnot cycle. They're much more isobaric than they are adiabatic. Well, they still have this big adiabatic, but they don't have the big isothermal. There's not really much here that is isothermal. Now, kind of as a little detail, if we look at this little piece, which in this homework problem is basically lined up to be a straight line process between this pressure and temperature and this pressure and temperature, if we want to do this in a reversible process, we don't literally want to put this cold water in all this hot water. That would mean that there'd be a big temperature difference when we were having a energy transfer, and it would lead to a big change in entropy. And as much as possible, to get the maximum possible efficiency, we want to have entropy changes of zero if possible. So if you look at this diagram, actually a whole lot of this has to do with taking this cold water and getting it up to a reasonable temperature before we throw it in the boiler. But we don't want to heat it up suddenly. We want to heat it up with stuff that has a pretty similar temperature. So we take this relatively low temperature steam from this low pressure turbine. It's only at 153 degrees Fahrenheit, and we use it to heat the water a little bit. Then we take this slightly hotter steam from this turbine and we heat it a little bit more. So every step of the way, we're trying to heat the water with something that has a temperature that's very close to it, which means that even though there's a heat transfer, so we have a positive Q and a negative Q, they're going to have pretty much the same temperature, so there'll be the smallest possible change in entropy. Right? If we literally just dumped this cold water into the boiler, there'd be a huge temperature difference when the energy transfer took place, and so there'd be a huge buildup of entropy. So in terms of real life, we want to do a much better job on that particular step. Okay. So, I don't know, let's take a look at some of the homework sort of problems. Oh, let me go back to this for a second, because it's actually similar to the sort of thing that we're going to do for the quiz. So in real life, what you do if you want to deal with a thermodynamic situation is you look up in books what the entropy is and the energy is. Those things are tabulated in your CRC. You don't use these sorts of equations, which are simplified versions of them. All of this thermodynamic data is nicely tabulated. So if I wanted to calculate, for example, how much work do I have to do in, excuse me, how much work will the gas do in going from this point 1B to 2, I can calculate it, right? Because that's an isobaric process, and I know what the pressure is. The pressure is 10 megapascals, and I know what the change in volume is, so I can calculate the work. So for this adiabatic process between 2 and 3, notice there's no change in entropy. Right? Better not be for an adiabatic process. But there is a big change in internal energy. Right? We're going from something that's more than 1,000 degrees to something that's basically room temperature-ish. And a lot of work is going to be done. How much work is going to be done? Well, we know that delta E has to equal W plus Q. And we know Q is zero, so we can figure out the work that the turbine is going to get, that the turbine is going to be able to do during this expansion between 2 and 3. Okay, so how much heat do we move out of the water between point 4A and 4B? How much cooling is going to have to occur? Well, we know what the entropy change is. We know what the temperature is. So we can use that equation to calculate the heat that we're going to have to pull out of this steam in order to recondense it into water. So we can use the actual numerical, tabulated numerical values for the internal energy and the entropy to actually calculate how this steam engine is going to work. Okay, so that's from real life to homework problems. So here we have a heat engine that operates between 25C and 375. What's the maximum possible efficiency? So this is maximum possible efficiency we know is Carnot cycle, and we know that that efficiency is 1 minus the cold temperature divided by the cold temperature divided by the hot temperature. So of course this is going to be 1 minus 25 over 375. Don't write that down, right? That's wrong. Right? Got to be an absolute, right? So we got to add 273 to the numerator and the denominator because these formulas, most formulas, want to have absolute temperature. Okay, so with that, we've got 373 and 25 and 375 and 273. Divide those guys and subtract it from 1, and I get 54%. Okay, straightforward plug and chug. Each cycle of its operation, a heat engine expels, so this is the heat that's being dumped into the cold temperature reserve, dumps 2,400 joules of energy, and we get out of it 1,800 joules of mechanical work. How much thermal energy must be added? Well, so that's back to these sorts of pictures. The heat we're dumping is the 24. The work that we're getting out is the 1,800. And together, those things have to equal the energy we pulled from the high temperature regime. So all we have to do is add those things up. And we get the energy we had to pull from the high temperature regime. What's the thermal efficiency of the engine? So this isn't a Carnot cycle. There's no reason to believe it's a Carnot cycle. So we're not expecting to use the Carnot cycle definition, but we can use the general definition of the efficiency of the heat engine, the coal we have to buy underneath the work we get out. So the coal we have to buy, that's the 4,200 joules. And what we got out of it was 1,800 joules of power that we could sell to people. And that's actually a pretty good efficiency for real world. It's about 43%. Yes? How much thermal energy must be added to the engine each cycle? So that's asking this. How much energy did we have to pull from the high temperature regime? Does that make sense? We know what we're dumping, we know what we're getting. Energy is conserved, it had to come from someplace. So we got a Carnot cycle that operates between these temperatures, which we know we have to add 273 to. And it says that it's going to absorb 21,000 joules of energy per cycle from the high temperature regime. And we're told that each cycle lasts 1 second. What's the mechanical power output of the engine? So what we've got here is the reminder that power is energy per time. So watts are joules per second. Now they've nicely picked a time that's 1 second, so it's going to look a whole lot like the power in watts is just the number of joules, but if we change that duration, which would be nice if they had, then they look a little bit differently. So what we know is how much energy we're pulling from that high temperature regime. That's the 21,000 joules. What we need to figure out is how much work we're getting out. And we know the efficiency of the engine because we know it's Carnot cycle and they tell us T hot and T cold. So the efficiency, 1 minus the 273 plus 80, 273 plus 350. Once we've got the efficiency, then the work that's going to happen will be the efficiency times the heat that we're pulling from the high temperature regime. And once we've got the work out, we're all set to plug it into that equation to get the power out. Okay, so plug and chug, we got the 273, we've got the 80, and we've got the 273, and we've got the 350. And I get 0.433 for the efficiency. And then I want to multiply that by the heat that we're pulling from the high temperature regime, 21,000. And that gives me the work of 9,100 joules. And we're getting 9,000 joules every second. So the power is going to be 9,100 watts. It's nearly 10 kilowatts, enough to power a house. How much energy does it expel each cycle in heat? So that's how much heat did we dump in this cold temperature regime. And we know what the heat in was, and we know what the work out was, this 9.1 times 10 to the third. So all we need to do is to subtract them in order to get the heat that we're going to dump into the river. And that's 11.9 times 10 to the third joules. Okay. So here we've got styrofoam cup holding 125 grams of water that for some reason they've decided to write in a funny fashion. It's at 100 degrees Celsius and it's going to cool to room temperature. What's the change in the entropy of the room? So the picture is we've got some hot water. It's going to cool down to 20 degrees. So we have heat that's being dumped into the room as the temperature of this water goes from 100 down to 20 degrees Celsius. So if we're calculating changes in entropy, this is the only formula we've got in the book. In order to use that formula, the temperature of what we're dealing with has to be constant. And I think we're supposed to assume that the room remains at 20 degrees Celsius. And we're going to add heat to the room, so it's going to end up with more disorder. The entropy is going to be increased. So how much heat is going to be transferred? Well, that's a Q equals MC delta T problem. The heat that the water is going to give off is going to be the mass times the specific heat times the change in temperature. We've got an eighth of a kilogram. I remember that the specific heat of water is 4186 joules per kilogram per degree Kelvin, and the change in temperature is 80 degrees. So if I did that, and maybe I should, as final minus initial, I'm going to get a negative number for that Q because the water is losing heat. But that heat is going as positive heat into the room. Okay, so absolute value of Q at least is going to be the 80. So I've got 0.125, 4186, and 80. And this heat that's ending up in the room is 4.186, I guess that's obvious, times 10 to the fourth. So the temperature is 20 degrees, so all I have to do is divide 20 into that, not, right? We got to add the 273. So what I've got is the 4186 times 10 to the fourth joules, and I've got the 293 Kelvin. And I get 143 joules per Kelvin, those are the units of entropy for this process.
Would you have to change the temperature change at the 20 minus 100? Would that have to change to like absolute temperature?
So, it's good to be writing this as final minus initial. So we've got 20 minus 80. So we get a Q that is negative for the heat loss from this piece of water. But the energy is conserved. So whatever energy the water loses, that energy is being dumped into the air. And if we add heat to something, Q is positive. So it's the same number, as it were, but here it's negative heat and here it's positive heat. Is that good? So heat is being dumped into the room. It's at that temperature. That's what its entropy is. Now, we can't do it with what's in the book, but let's calculate what the change in entropy of the water is. Because the claim is that the total change in entropy better be greater than zero. Is that, in fact, going to pan out? So the change in entropy of the water, that's going to be the mass times the specific heat times the natural logarithm of these temperatures. Now remember, got to have absolute temperatures. So the final temperature is 293 and the initial temperature is 373. So if I plug this all through, 293, 373, divide that. Remember, it's going to be a fraction. When you take the logarithm of a fraction, you get a negative number. And then I've got that times 4186 and 0.125. And what I get for it is an entropy that is minus 126. So you can see that the change in the entropy of the universe, the room plus the cup, is in fact positive, as is required by the second law of thermodynamics. What's the change in the entropy of 1 kilogram of water at its boiling point when it changes to steam at its boiling point? So this is nicely set up so that we can use this equation, which is the only one we actually have, for calculating changes in entropy, because the temperature didn't change. The temperature was always 373. How much energy does it take to boil water? Well, that's latent heat of vaporization. And we can flip back to the table. So water is this one. So the latent heat of vaporization is 2.26 times 10 to the 6th joules per kilogram. And we've got 1 kilogram, don't we? Isn't that the problem? Yep, 1 kilogram. So the heat we're going to add is this 2.26 times 10 to the 6th joules. It's all happening at a temperature that is 100 plus 273, or 373. And to calculate that change in entropy, all we have to do is do that division. Right? So we got 2.26 enter exponent 6 and 373 divided by, and what we get is 6.06 times 10 to the 3rd joules in the numerator, Kelvin in the denominator, so joules per Kelvin, the proper units for entropy. So this is another problem that's bringing back those latent heats of fusion. So here we have a Carnot cycle that's operating between boiling point of water and basically room temperature. How much ice can be melt from its exhaust after it is done 5 times 10 to the 4th joules of work? Well, so from the temperature, we can get the efficiency. And using the efficiency in reverse, we can get the amount of heat we pulled from the high temperature regime. And then we can subtract off this work and we'll get how much heat we dumped in the cold temperature regime. And then we can equate that to a certain mass of ice at 3.33 times 10 to the 5th joules per kilogram, the latent heat of fusion of ice, right? Going back to this table. Okay, so I don't know, that's the plan. So calculate the efficiency. We can calculate the efficiency of Carnot cycles just based on their temperatures, and it's 1 minus the cold temperature divided by the hot temperature. And so that's not 20 divided by 100. That's 20 plus 273, which is 293. Divided by 100 plus 273, which is 373. So that's going to be our Carnot efficiency. So we got 293 and 373. Ooh, I don't know what I did, but it didn't make sense. 273, 373.
It's 293.
Ah, I don't know. I'll do it again, but I got 22% this time. 293, 373. I think I did it right both times. So this is basically a fifth. So if I know the efficiency is the ratio of the work I got out divided by the heat I had to pull from the high temperature regime. So the heat I had to pull from the high temperature regime is the work, I mean bring the efficiency down and the heat up, divided by the efficiency. And the work, we're told, is 5 times 10 to the fourth. And what we get is 2.33 times 10 to the fifth joules. Okay, so kind of draw the picture. So here we have this 2.33 times 10 to the fifth. The work that we're getting out, that's this 5 times 10 to the fourth. So what we're going to dump, all we have to do is subtract the 5 times 10 to the fourth. And what I get is 1.83 times 10 to the fifth joules. Okay, so that's how much heat we have to melt the ice. How much ice is that going to melt? Well, we know that Q is equal to the mass times the latent heat of fusion. So the mass of ice that's going to melt, we can look up the latent heat of fusion. That's the 3.33 times 10 to the fifth joules per kilogram. So the mass is going to be this heat that we're dumping, 1.83 times 10 to the fifth, divided by this latent heat. And I get a little bit more than half a kilogram. Okay. So not nearly as many equations that we had last time, but some of them are kind of obscure, like this idea of entropy. The one good thing about entropy is there's only one equation that we have for it, so I can't disguise it a whole lot. And typically, how I think we're going to use it more commonly is the reverse, right? If we've got these sorts of tables of entropy, we can look at the difference in entropy, the change in entropy, and we can figure out the heats by running that equation backwards. Same thing as we can figure out the works that are done in, for example, this adiabatic expansion by looking at the change in internal energy. Okay, so that's kind of what the quiz is going to be on. Think about Carnot pass, entropy, these sorts of things in the context of a table kind of like that.